It's Tuesday, the 12th of October 2004, and this is David Talbot interviewing Fred Richardson on behalf of the Museum and Archives of the Duke of Wellington's Regiment. Fred served in the regiment both during and after the Second World War, but before this he was at school and in the Air Training Corps from 1941-3. He was conscripted into the Royal Air Force in August 1943, served a year in the Royal Air Force, and then was moved over to the army, and he'll tell me all about this in the interview. But in order to get a proper, well-rounded picture of you as a young man, Fred, we need a bit of background, not just about how you came to be in the Duke's, but what sort of young man you were. And to find this out, really, we have to go back before the war and to look a little bit at your early life as a boy. The usual starting point is you can tell me when and where you were born and what was your father's job. So, over to you.
Well, my father was a cold storage engineer with a local firm of butchers who were well established in Watford, and he worked there for many years after he came out of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry after his service in the First World War. I was born locally in Watford in July 1925. Usual sort of schooling, but until 14, when I sat an exam to go to a technical school, which was a two-year course. So I left that school at 16.
So this is in the mid-1930s sometime, late 1930s?
Yes.
That you're at the technical school.
At the technical school, I was there 1939 to 1941.
Right.
And I won two medals there for running. I seem to have always been interested and involved in sports. On leaving the technical school in 1941, I went to work at Messrs Scammell Lorries Limited, which was a local heavy vehicle manufacturers, where I worked until being conscripted into the Air Force in 1943. During those 2 years that I worked at Scammell Lorries, that was the time when I was a member of the Air Training Corps, and it was as a result of being in the Air Training Corps that I was able to join the Air Force. There was an arrangement that people being called up, if they were in the Air Force, if they were in the Air Training Corps, they would be automatically taken into the Air Force. I, after 6 months basic training, which included 4 months training as an engine mechanic, I was posted to a Lancaster squadron, number 619 squadron, based in Lincolnshire, preparing aeroplanes to go on raids, which was very intensive on the build-up towards D-Day. Whereas normally the RAF bombed at night, in the build-up to D-Day, they did carry out some daylight raids as well as nighttime.
Did you enjoy this job?
Yes, I found it very interesting. And I took an interest in it, and I found that by taking an interest, it generated interest in other aspects of the work, which again made it more interesting, and it avoided too much routine. I did enjoy the time. It was hard going, but...
Did they suffer many casualties?
Yes. Most raids, there was a loss of two or three. And what amazed me was the rapidity at which the replacements were supplied to the squadron, that there must have been many storage depots, pardon me, in the country where they could bring replacements from.
And were you able to continue your sporting activities while you were...
Not at that time. I was able to during the first 6 months because we had cross-country runs in training. No actual sporting events, but plenty of exercise. And I always did well at the cross-country running. And of course, the general, what should I say, basic training, which involved assault courses and that sort of thing, came easy to me.
So, in Lincolnshire, working on Lancasters, why was it that your time doing this came to an end?
Well, the D-Day took place and many squadrons were moved onto the continent, which meant shorter flights, fewer ground staff, and many of us were transferred into the army in order to build up the ground forces for the far east as the Japanese war was still on. That led me down to Bovington Camp in Dorsetshire, the home of the Tank Corps.
Did you have any choice as to which you were going into?
Not really. I may have it may have been possible for me to avoid the transfer into the army because we had a medical before being transferred, and the medical officer asked me if I'd ever had any trouble with my feet, and I said no, that I'd done a lot of cross-country running and a lot of swimming and hadn't had any trouble with them. His comment then was, well, in that case I cannot downgrade you, so you'll have to go in the army, and hence that's where I went.
Did you have a lot more square bashing to do then?
Yes, we had to do it almost exactly the same. The basic training was 2 months in both the Air Force and the Army, where it was, in the Army it was the same as in the Air Force virtually, but it came as no difficulty to me.
Were you training with people who were newly into the forces, or were they all transfers from the Air Force?
They were mainly transfers, not only from the Air Force, but from the Royal Navy. In fact, some personnel that were transferred, they really didn't see service in both the Air Force or the Navy, because they were transferred en bloc straight into the Army, all their actual service was in the Army. In the case of us who had done time previously in another service, the work that we'd done in the other service helped us in the Army, because having been an engine mechanic in the Royal Air Force, we became driver mechanics in the Royal Armoured Corps, and this was when passing out. If one passed out at the end of the mechanical course, one became a driver mechanic. If failing the course, one became a B vehicle driver.
And you passed, presumably.
I passed. It was almost a point of honour that having undergone the training and taken the exam, it was almost a point of honour, the same as it was in the Air Force, that I passed.
What happened to you next then?
Well, next was we waited at Bovington camp for a draft overseas, and this led to us having two lots of embarkation leave. We had 1 week's embarkation leave, returned to the camp, only to find that arrangements had not been possible for us to be put on draft, so we were sent home again. We didn't complain about this. Then when we returned after the second embarkation leave, we were put on draft to the Far East, and this led to an overnight train journey to Liverpool docks, where we boarded the troop ship to travel to India. Perhaps I could mention that during the time I was at Bovington camp, I was once involved with the military police by missing the last bus in Bournemouth to Bournemouth station, so hence I missed the last train, and whilst waiting on Bournemouth station, was picked up by the MPs, who questioned me as to what I was doing there, and I told the truth that I was waiting for the milk train to take me back to Bovington camp, and the MPs said, "Oh, well, that's all right then." And I took it that it was all right. So I was very surprised when, during the week, I was called to the CO's office and asked why I hadn't reported being picked up by the military police. And I could only comment that they had said it was all right. I took it to mean that it was all right. And not having been in trouble before, I didn't know the procedure.
Were you on a charge as a result?
No, fortunately we were getting near the end of the course where we would be posted overseas, and I was absolved. So, no, there was no punishment, no charge of punishment.
Tell me, Fred, about this posting. You're in the Royal Armoured Corps. Are you at this stage in a unit within it, or just in general?
It was a main training camp. It was the 52nd training regiment of the Royal Armoured Corps, it was a main training camp for Royal Armoured Corps personnel.
This is when you get to India, is it now?
This is the training camp in this country at Bovington camp.
All right, Bovington.
Yes. We left Bovington on the overnight train journey to Liverpool, where we boarded the SS Strathaden to take us to India. And at this time, blackout was still enforced. The European war was still on, but we were either 3 or 5 days at sea when VE Day was declared. The celebrations consisted of 2 bottles of beer a man, and as I don't drink, I passed mine on to somebody else. The trip out was interesting. It was rather like a school geography lesson come to life. We left in a convoy, which was rather a magnificent sight. We travelled halfway out into the Atlantic before cutting down to Gibraltar. We didn't stop at Gibraltar, we just pulled into the bay, dropped off a couple of seamen, and then we struck across the Med to Kola, Algiers, where we embarked some French and French Indo-Chinese troops. And then we set sail again through the Med to Suez Canal. There was first of all a stop at Port Suez for various resupplying, where the inevitable bum boats made their presence felt, wishing to sell items to the troops. We then proceeded through the Suez Canal. This was all rather interesting. At about the halfway point, there are some natural lakes where we harboured up overnight. And then when we awoke the next morning, we were at the other end of the Suez Canal, which I believe is termed Port Tewfik. From there, we proceeded to Aden. Then from Aden down to Colombo in what was then Ceylon, where the French and French Indo-Chinese troops were disembarked. And then the troop ship made its way up the coast of India to Bombay. We stayed in Bombay overnight and all the next day. Fortunately, I met one of the ship's crew members whose father had worked at Scammel Lorries during the 2 years that I was there before being called up. So he took half a dozen of us, as he knew the town, he took half a dozen of us to a rather selective club known as Breach Candy, where they had a swimming pool, an indoor one and an outdoor one. So we spent most of the day there, which was very pleasant. We returned to the troop ship, and the following morning we disembarked with our kit and marched to the railway station, where we boarded the train to be taken to Pune, which was the depot for Royal Armoured Corps personnel in India. And from this depot, I was posted to what was then designated the 146 Regiment Royal Armoured Corps at Ahmednagar. At this time, I did not know that the 146 Regiment Royal Armoured Corps was actually the 9th Battalion of the Duke of Wellington Regiment, the 9th Battalion being one of the two battalions that had been converted to armour earlier in the war, when the government realised they needed much more armour than they had, and so a number of battalions of various infantry regiments were converted to armour. The other Duke of Wellington Regiment battalion that was converted was the 8th Battalion. It was thought that I would have to be posted elsewhere because the regiment was fully manned. But as I was trade tested, I was taken on the strength, and presumably somebody else was posted. What I didn't know at this time was I would have gone to the 149 Regiment Royal Armoured Corps, which was a battalion of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry that had also been converted.
What are your duties then?
With the 9th Battalion?
Was tank driver with Sherman. Well, first of all, we had Grant tanks, which were great big things and were old-fashioned at the time. We then had Sherman tanks, and being a tank driver, it was my responsibility to ensure that the tank was mechanically sound. We had routine inspections, daily inspections, general maintenance. And this was the procedure until August 1945, when the Japanese war finished, at which time we had our tanks taken from us and replaced with armoured cars and put on internal security duties. We tended to call them anti-riot duties, because at this time there was much agitation within the country of India for independence, and there was much trouble. One of the main aspects of this time was the Indian Navy mutinying in Bombay Harbour, and the battalion being called to duty in Bombay, which meant a drive of about 200 miles from Ahmednagar through Pune onto Bombay, putting up at Kalyan Transit Camp overnight, so that we got ourselves together and went into Bombay in an organised parade.
Did you have to do any actual fighting for people?
No, we didn't. Some members did. They were more the detached members who had sort of like individual duties. From our point of view, the threat of armoured cars was sufficient. We had things to cope with, like barricades across the roads, oil drums filled with rocks and stones, dispatch riders were the most vulnerable.
But you didn't have to fire any...
We didn't have to fire in anger at all, no. Fortunately.
How long did this last, this presence in Bombay? Just a matter of days?
It was a matter of days, yes. I don't actually know how many, because at the time, you concentrating on what one has to do. We had to, some of us had to one night drive through the streets of Bombay to the outskirts to guide in vehicles that had been left at Ahmednagar, either in workshops or for various reasons, and they were being brought into Bombay. In Bombay, we were based at Colaba Camp, that's spelt C-O-L-A-B-A. That was our base. The journey from Ahmednagar to Bombay was not incident-free for myself, because I'd never driven down the Ghats before, and it was night time, and I couldn't see the slope, and as the armoured car was running freely in second gear, I attempted to change up into third gear, but whilst the gear was in neutral, the car started to speed up, so I had to brake, put the gear lever back into second gear, and just grind down till we came to the end of the Ghats.
How do you spell Ghats?
G-H-A-T-S, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we turned off the main road to go along a sort of trackway to Kalyan Transit Camp, And again, I met with misfortune. I hit a pile of road making materials on the side of the road, and the armoured car turned over, not completely. It fell against one of the few trees. So it was perched there until the recovery vehicle and fitters came along.
Do you have any passengers with you?
I had one, but he'd fallen asleep. We were undermanned at this stage because each squadron of the regiment had a week's camp at a place named Carrick Vasla, which was a lake area fairly near to Ahmednagar. And it was our luck, it was C Squadron's luck, that the squadron was at this camp for a rest period. As my armoured car was in workshops, I had to stay behind with it. This meant that the crew member given me as the commander was not trained as such. He was just, you know, put on the armoured car.
Was he injured?
No, he was down inside, actually. That's where he was falling asleep.
What about you? Were you hurt?
No, but there was rather a humorous finish to this because the battery for the armoured car was on the side of the driver. So as it turned over, acid spilled out and onto my overalls, which burnt large areas of them. So when we pulled into Bombay in the morning and we all lined up along Marine Drive, which is a main driveway in Bombay, I could not leave the armoured car to stretch my legs because I only had my PT shorts on underneath. So that was just, incidental.
So that was more worrying than anything that had happened to you when you got to Bombay.
Well, yes, really, yes. So...
And then it's back to Pune again, is it?
It was back to Pune. And to backtrack a bit, it was at the time that the Japanese war finished that the 146 Regiment Royal Armoured Corps ceased to exist and again became the 9th Battalion of the Duke of Wellington Regiment. At this time, the battalion was about 85% ex-RAF and ex-naval personnel. All the personnel who had been with the battalion for 5 or 6 years had been repatriated, and we were all there to bring the regiment, the battalion, up to strength again.
What did they find for you to do then in Pune when you were back there? Was it any enjoyable existence?
Well, it was general duties sort of thing, various exercises. At one time, they decided that there were too many trained personnel and for armoured vehicles, and so some of us were given B vehicles to drive, and I had a 1500 weight Dodge, which I liked very much. I found that being fully enclosed in the armoured car tended to upset me to some extent. And the being changed to a 1500 weight vehicle, which was very open.
What were you carrying in it?
Various things. It was used as a general purpose vehicle. We had one trip of about 4 days where the area headquarters was touring round various units, and we were employed in carrying all their baggage, which was very pleasant. It was always the case that outer camp was much pleasanter than being static in camp.
And were you able to start your sporting activities again?
Not to any great extent. I did take part in a cross-country run that represented the regiment. There were two, how shall I put this, these days, it would have been all right in those days, but it was an area cross-country championship, and there were two teams from British regiments, and I took part to represent the Duke of Wellington's, and we had carried out our training in the mornings when it was cooler, because we thought that the run would be in the morning, but it turned out it was in the afternoon, so it was extremely hot, and I was doing well. I was the first man of the two British regiments, but with about a mile from the finish, I passed out, and they had to come from the camp to fetch me.
What other memories of Poona have you got?
A very nice canteen for forces. Lady Lumley, she started up a chain of forces canteens. There was various restaurants that we could go to. Cinema. It was there that I saw Henry V, which was a classical film made at the time. And speaking of classical, it was whilst at Ahmednagar that the Duke of Aosta in Italy brought an orchestra. They were doing a tour of India as part of the reparations, and it was advertised as a classical concert, which of course put almost everybody off immediately. But for the want of something else to do, I went, and that was my first introduction to classical orchestras, which I found quite enjoyable.
How long were you based in Poona for then?
We had it's difficult to say without a lot of thinking. We went from Ahmednagar, we went to Poona, because with the general contraction of troops in India, the camp at Ahmednagar was closed, and we were withdrawn to Poona. At Poona, I did get myself into trouble. We were doing a guard about every three or four nights, and on one guard, I was doing the last 2 hours, and I became unwell, and I managed to stay on my feet until it became light. I was hoping that either the sergeant or the orderly officer would come round, but nobody arrived until I couldn't stand any longer. I squatted, and with that, the orderly officers came round the end of the hangar. This led to me being called before the CO, who offered me either to be charged or accept his punishment. Well, I accepted his punishment, which involved me in removing the green paint from all the shovels off the vehicles so that the white wood showed. This I didn't take very kindly to, actually, because it meant sore fingers, difficulty with eating, but nonetheless, it was done. Could we have a pause, please?
Yes, I think we could. So we've just been talking of one of your more painful memories of India, Fred. Your service with the Dukes, presumably at some time, begins to draw to a close in India.
Yes. It came to an end in Pune. I think it was early 1947. Without looking up in a book that I have of the history of the Duke of Wellington Regiment, I cannot be certain of the date, but in early 1947, it was decided that the 9th Battalion of the Duke of Wellington Regiment would be broken up, again on this basis of doing away with territorial battalions, heading towards
You must have been getting fairly near the end of your service anyhow by now.
Well, yes, when they broke up the Duke of Wellington Regiment, many of us were posted to North India, to the 7th Royal Tank Regiment, and that was the finish of my time with the 9th Battalion.
And were you driving tanks again?
I kept to B vehicles, which I enjoyed because there was more to do on the armoured vehicles. They were in camp a lot, whereas driving the B vehicles, there were many more miscellaneous duties, and I found that more interesting to be occupied. And just as an aside, it was whilst driving a 3-ton truck at the 7th Royal Tank Regiment in Sialkot, North India, that I met Jimmy Perry of Dad's Army fame, who was in a Stars in Battle Dress concert party, and it turned out that both he and I were local lads from Watford. So it gave us something in common.
And by now, I suppose, you were beginning to count the weeks to DMARD, weren't you?
True, yes. There was always comments being passed around about there are ships in the bay, and we'd all get excited, and then somebody would say, but they're not troop ships. So the time came when we were looking forward. Eventually, my DMOB group arrived, which was number 56. We came by train in 24 hours from Sialkot down to Dulali, whereas when we were posted from Pune to Sialkot, it took us 6 days on the train. That was being shunted into sidings, having to wait for engines, passenger trains and expresses given priority.
And this was a bit quicker, was it?
And this was 24 hours, which was quite remarkable.
Yeah.
I saw much of the country, the travelling on the train both ways, and looking back, well, they say one remembers the good times, which is very true, because I found my time in the services not only interesting, but it stood me in good stead in civilian life.
In what way?
The fact of being organised, taking an interest in things, being systematic. One of the things learnt in my Air Force training was that if you haven't got the correct tools, improvise. And so it's all led me to think that things can be done by a little application.
What did you do when you came back to civilian life?
I returned to Scammell Lorries Limited, and strangely enough, it was all office work, but I maintained an interest in vehicles. I joined the peacetime Civil Defence Corps as a part-time member, in which I became an instructor both of subjects and a driving instructor. That lasted just over 13 years when it was disbanded. I also joined the St John Ambulance Brigade at the age of 50. I served 15 years in that. And one further thing with regards to the Duke of Wellington's, I am a long-time member of the London branch of the Duke of Wellington Regiment's Old Comrades Association.
Why do you feel such loyalty to it? Because presumably you served even longer, or about the same amount of time in the Air Force.
I think because it was rather more specific. Royal Armoured Corps covered lots of regiments. The Tank Corps, there were a number of tank regiments. The Air Force was, what should I say, a large organisation, and although I was on a squadron, that was not for very long because of the transfer into the army. So I think that is why I have a loyalty towards it. And during my time as a member of the Old Comrades, I have served on the committee as a committee member and for a time as chairman of the organisation.
Well, so, I wonder, Fred, if that's a good point on which to stop.
It probably is, yes.
Thank you very much indeed for talking with me.
Yes. Well, I've enjoyed it and found it interesting.
Me too.